I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The latest deadline for an agreement over Iran's nuclear program has come and gone. Now the P5 plus one negotiators are looking at July 10th, Friday, as the new deadline. The UN foreign policy chief said that both sides agree that getting the right agreement is more important than any single deadline. The current sticking point involves Iran's demand that all the UN sanctions, including on its ballistic missile program, be lifted. Western negotiators want to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Iran says its program is for civilian, for peaceful use. We asked Joe Cirincione to join us. He's president of the Plowshares Fund. That's a global security foundation. He's the author of Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late. He's also a member of the Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board. And Joe Cirincione, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. At some point, is this deadline going to actually mean something?
They're a little fuzzy on this one, but frankly, the negotiators are getting a little tired of Vienna. They are hoping that they can wrap this up by the end of the week. Thursday night, Friday morning is sort of the deadline that many of us are now expecting. We are very, very close to a deal. They actually have solved most of the very difficult problems. The ones that are remaining are tough, but nothing compared to what they've already reached solutions on.
Well, let me ask you about one, which is this demand from Iran that the UN lift all its sanctions, including on Iran's ballistic missile program. Is that on the table? Is that acceptable?
It is on the Iranian side of the table, but it's not going to happen. It would be completely unseemly to reach an agreement that's going to constrain Iran's nuclear program and in return give them access to some of their frozen funds, tens of millions, billions of dollars, and then at the same time be lifting sanctions that would allow them to buy arms, buy parts for their missile program. It just won't fly, and no pun intended. And the U.S. negotiators have let them know that. Just so you know, inside the coalition that's negotiating with Iran, the P5 plus one, that's the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, so that's Russia and China and Britain and France and us and Germany, there's been some disagreement over this. China and Russia have been more willing to lift the embargo, but in solidarity with the group, they have blocked against it. So I think Iran will back down from that demand.
And how sophisticated is its ballistic missile program? Do you know?
They have a number of short-range missiles that can reach their neighbors. So these are like Scud-like missiles that can go, 300 miles or so. They also have intermediate-range missiles that can go as far as Israel, that do threaten Israel. And that's the range that they're testing. That's what they'd like more parts for. They're years away from anything long-range that could hit Europe, for example, or the United States. But we want to keep them that way. So I believe the missile sanctions will remain. The embargo on buying heavy arms will remain.
There's some question about inspectors and how much access they will have to these various sites. There's the word that has, been added is managed access. How do you interpret that word? What does that mean?
So this became controversial as part of the inspection regime, which by all indications is going to be one of the most intrusive regimes ever negotiated. We're going to have eyes and ears everywhere. But that includes being able to go to some sensitive sites, including military sites, where we suspect they have done work on nuclear weapons research in the past. The supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, gave a speech about 2 weeks ago where he said we never would allow inspections on these military facilities, but he added an adjective, unconventional inspections. And this is the art of diplomacy, defining, well, what is conventional? What is unconventional? We believe this problem actually has been solved. There is something called the Agreed Protocol. It's an arrangement that allows the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect any suspect sites as long as they give a little warning and that the terms of the access are then negotiated. This is pretty standard operating procedure. You understand that countries are a little sensitive to some sites. We are too. We don't allow inspectors to come into our military facilities. But I think we'll be able to go where we need to go when we need to do it.
But that's not unfettered, which I assume unfettered means you can go anywhere at any time, whenever you want.
It's not unfettered, but the only way you get unfettered inspections is when you occupy a country. After the Iraq War, for example, when countries are forced to do this. Iran is willing to be transparent. It's actually been one of the ways that they've been giving a lot on this front. But they want to maintain normal procedures. They don't want to do anything that other countries aren't required to do. This arrangement allows them to do that. It'll be inspections agreed to under the standard protocols, but we will be able to go anywhere, anytime. A mechanism has been set up. I think we'll be hearing a lot more of that in the days after the deal.
The New York Times had an article about the IAEA inspectors. I'll just quote a sentence saying the job is so daunting that the agency's inspectors frequently describe themselves as overwhelmed, monitoring a modern nuclear infrastructure with Betamax-era equipment. Is that what we're dealing with? Is there that kind of a disconnect here?
Well, this is what's going to change. The new agreement will rev everything up to 21st century technology. So we're going to have modern seals, for example, on equipment. And these aren't, you know, Game of Thrones wax seals on parchment paper. These are fiber optic seals where if they're tampered with, they send a signal back to headquarters immediately, instantaneously. So you no longer require, as these inspectors were talking about, the old technology where there'd be a seal and they'd be have to inspect it weeks later to see if it had been tampered with. We'll have sensors and cameras and audits and inventory controls over their entire operation. So there'll be the inspections right now, as the IAEA was quoted as saying, are comprehensive, but they're limited. This new agreement will basically take the limits off. We were going to be tracking Iran's uranium from the time it comes out of the mine all the way through the process until it ends up as a gas in cylinders in warehouses. And if the end product weighs less than the beginning ore that came out of the mine, well, where did the rest of it go? That's why you're doing these inspections, to make sure none of the material is being diverted to secret facilities.
Now, Iran has said that its nuclear program is for civilian purposes, for peaceful purposes. Can we believe them? Is that true?
I don't think so. I believe it may be true now, but the evidence in the past is largely circumstantial but pretty overwhelming that during the 80s and 90s and up until about 2003, according to the national intelligence estimates, Iran was conducting research on nuclear weapons. This is a program that began under the Shah, our ally. He started doing the work on this. He started building the first facilities. It ended when the Iranian Revolution came in 1979. But the supreme leader then started it up during the Iran-Iraq War. Iran was being attacked by Iraq using chemical munitions. Thousands were being killed. The world didn't do anything about it. That's when he started up the nuclear program again, according to the best intelligence we have. It looks like they ended it around 2003 when some of the facilities were discovered and a spotlight was shone on it. But we want to get at the history. We want to understand more exactly what they did it, who was involved. And that's why you need these inspections. That's why you have to be able to go to some of these military facilities. You have to be able to interview the scientists, get the history to make sure that all that nuclear weapons work has ended, and what you have left is purely the peaceful program that Iran claims it is.
Can Iran be trusted on this issue?
No, I don't think so. I don't trust Iran.
Trust but verify?
I think it's mistrust and verify, and that's the whole point here. I don't trust the Iranians. They have a history of hiding their facilities from us. We have a history of discovering their facilities. I think there are Iranians who don't trust other Iranians. So this is not about what we think their intentions are or whether we have a good personal relationship with the foreign minister or the president. It's about being able to strike a very detailed deal. This agreement is going to be dozens of pages long, 80 pages or so, with incredible precision built in, more than almost any other agreement I've seen, and then being able to set up a verification and monitoring system. So if Iran tries to sneak out or creep out or break out, we'll catch them.
Is it important then to keep this P5 plus one together and on the same page to ensure that there is not just an agreement, but that they abide by this particular agreement?
That is a key point, Marty. I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, even at the same time that we're having big differences with Russia over Ukraine, for example, Russia's been cooperating on this. China's been cooperating on this. And that has made a big difference. The sanctions that helped bring Iran to the table are not just U.S. sanctions, not just our ban on trade with Iran. We don't really trade with Iran. But it's been the Europeans and the Asian allies and the rest of the world that has tightened the sanctions net, that has made it very, very difficult for Iran to do business. So their oil exports, for example, dropped in half. The value of their currency dropped by 60%. Things like that. They're very hard to do business in the world. They want out of that. That's why they're negotiating. But in order to keep that pressure on and in order to keep that sanctions regime in place so that if Iran does cheat, you can punish them. You can snap back the inspections. You've got to keep the unity. You've got to keep the Russians, the Europeans, the Chinese all together. So far, we've been very successful in doing that.
So who do you think needs this agreement more, Iran, the United States, P5 plus one? I mean, it seems like there are a lot of reputations on the line here.
There are, and that is always a factor here. I would say right now Iran needs it more than we do for basically for two reasons. Mr. Rouhani, the president of Iran, and I've met him on several occasions, was elected on an economic reform package. It wasn't about negotiating with the West. It was about getting the economy going again. But in order to do that, he has to end the sanctions. In order to do that, he has to make a deal. He's up for re-election in 2 years. There are important elections next year for the parliament and other government bodies. He needs this deal in order to kickstart the economy, in order to aid his political faction in the complex Byzantine-Iranian political system. But there's another reason. The Middle East, as all your listeners know, is in a chaotic situation. We don't live there. Iran does. They're in the middle of this. They feel besieged by the chaos around them, and they are intervening in many of these conflicts. They say to protect their interests. We look at it as somewhat stoking the conflicts. They need to break out of the diplomatic isolation they're in and try to and re-engage the West, re-engage the United States in particular, to try to find some solutions to the instability in their region. That's a reason why we might be interested in having a deal with Iran, but mostly it's to stop their nuclear program. Mm. If Iran's not willing to make a deal now, we can wait.
Almost having a break here. Does President Obama need this deal for his legacy?
This would undoubtedly be a major achievement for the president. It would be most likely his major foreign policy accomplishment. But the president's on a roll lately. I mean, he's racked up some big legacy items just in the past couple of weeks. Would this help with his legacy? Yes. Does he need it? No.
That's Joe Cirincione, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, president of the Plowshares Fund. That's a global security foundation. And we are talking about the negotiations currently going on in Vienna. The P5 plus one, as they're called, negotiating with Iran over its nuclear program. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. What do you want out of this agreement? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Joe Cirincione, again, president of the Plowshares Fund. And we are talking about the negotiations going on between Iran and the P5 plus one. Of course, the United States part of that negotiating team. And we've got a lot of calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Joe, someone tweeted they wanted to know about how many votes needed in Congress to approve an Iran agreement. And, of course, this was something that was negotiated in June here in this country about what say Congress would have on whatever deal came down the pike.
Congress passed a bit of legislation called the Corker-Cardin legislation after the two senators who headed it up that established an oversight process. So after this deal is struck, it will go before the Congress, but it's not a treaty. So it doesn't have to be approved by the Congress. So it doesn't need a two-thirds majority to be approved. But Congress has the ability to suspend the president's ability to lift the sanctions. So remember, part of this deal is Iran agrees to stop its program, slash its equipment, dismantle a great part of it, open up for inspections, and in return, we lift the sanctions on them. Congress can stop the president from lifting the sanctions, in effect killing the deal. But in order to do that, they will have to, one, pass a resolution of disapproval. And then when the president vetoes that, as he certainly will, they have to be able to sustain that against the president's veto. That does require two-thirds, and it's unlikely that the political opposition to the president in the Senate and the House can get the Democrats to overturn a presidential veto. So right now, that's the game. That's what it looks like. So it will require two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate in the end to vote to block the president from suspending any sanctions. That would kill the deal. We'd likely to see that play out sometime in September.
And looking at the sanctions, is there a timetable for how they would be lifted depending on what Iran does?
Yes, but we don't know what that timetable is
we
yet.
We don't. Okay,
That's one of the sticking points, is four or five sticking points in the end, and the actual sequencing of when that's going to happen is being worked out. And it involves a very sort of a diplomatic dance of phasing in this agreement. We don't want to lift sanctions until we're sure Iran is implementing the deal, actually taking apart the equipment, and they don't want to take apart the equipment until they know they're going to get sanctions relief. So you got to time this thing very delicately.
What about Iran's support for terrorism, its human rights record, its non-recognition of Israel? Is that in any way part of these negotiations? Or should they be?
They are deeply troubling. I mean, this is not a pleasant regime. Iran executes about 1,000 people a year, more than any other country in the region. They support Hamas and Hezbollah, who are foes of our ally Israel. So we disapprove of a lot of Iran's behavior in the region, but that's not what this negotiation is about. If you do that, you will break the table. You can't possibly resolve all those issues at once. So we're taking care of the most threatening, which is the nuclear program. As bad as Iran's behavior is, it might be worse if they actually got a nuclear weapon. And then we'll see whether this opens up new channels of communication, avenues for addressing these other issues.
Are you of the mind that if there is a good deal or a good enough deal, that over time that will have some kind of a moderating influence on the Iranian government, on its behavior in its neighborhood, also on domestic issues as well? Is that some of your thinking?
It is, and I do think that, and I'm informed by human rights activists and civic activists inside Iran. There's a group called the International Campaign for Human Rights on Iran, for example. You can Google them, look them up. They recently did a survey of several dozen activists inside Iran about what their expectations were, and they all back this deal. Not that they actually care one way or the other about the nuclear program, but they see it as a beginning, as a way that will empower Rouhani, who's the president of Iran, and a pragmatist who campaigned not just on economic stimulation, but on opening up freedoms for the Iranian people and establishing a more moderate government. They think this will empower him and could be the opening that they're looking for. That's why you saw these massive crowds greet the news of even the interim agreement, this framework that was announced on April 2nd. Foreign Minister Zarif was mobbed on the way home from the airport, not because they reached some complicated agreement on inspections and the nuclear program, because they see this as a ray of hope, the beginning of change in the regime. Whether that will happen, we don't know. That will require a lot of struggle. But yes, I think this deal could be the beginning of big change inside Iran and in Iran's relationship with us and in relations with its neighbors, including Israel.
I do want to get to that. Let me get a couple of callers here. We have Vance calling us from Northeast Philadelphia. Vance, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My comment is, I think the United States and their negotiating partners are hypocrites, and that all of them possess nuclear weapons, and no one has called Israel on the table for their nuclear arsenal.
Well, Vance, let me give Joe Cerencioni a chance to respond to that. And I knew this question would come up, and I'm sure you've certainly heard it before. Joe, what is your response to that?
Well, this is a point the Iranians make quite often. The caller is absolutely right. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council all have nuclear weapons. The U.S. and Russia have thousands of nuclear weapons, about 96% of all the weapons in the world. So this is a point. And Israel has somewhere around 100 nuclear weapons in an undeclared arsenal. This is also a point the Iranians make. And the point we make back is yes, and there are other forms for addressing that, including the United Nations, including the Non-Proliferation Treaty process. But we're not talking about those now. We're talking about your program. You swore when you signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty you wouldn't do nuclear weapons research. We caught you doing it. That's why the sanctions were imposed. That's why we're talking about you now.
It's complicated, isn't it?
Is it a hypocritical problem? Do you have a problem as long as you maintaining thousands of weapons and you're telling Iran they can't have one? Yes, but the legal and diplomatic arguments are overweigh that at this point, and they're on our side.
An email from Paul, he says, if Iran wants to build a nuclear weapon and threat of sanctions deal doesn't happen, is there any way to stop them? Aren't their production facilities deep underground, safe from conventional bombs? Does anyone really expect the U.S. to start a war with Iran by bombing their nuclear installations, Joe?
Well, that's why this diplomatic deal is so promising. It's not without risk, and there are going to be problems with it. It won't be a perfect agreement, but it is far better than the risks of all the alternatives. If the deal falls apart, especially if the U.S. is seen as the reason it falls apart, if the Congress kills this deal, so Iran agrees, everybody else agrees, and then we back out, and what happens is the sanction regime will then more or less rapidly fall apart. Other countries are not going to go along with anything we do. It doesn't matter if the Senate passes new sanctions or not. The other countries aren't going to go along with it. I don't mean just Russia and China. I mean Japan and Korea and Europe, the people who buy Iran's oil. And that means that Iran's economy will, in fact, start to recover. And the inspection regimes that are in place will be ended. The restraints on Iran's program will end, and they will start installing more centrifuges, enriching more uranium, getting closer and closer to a bomb. Whether they cross it or not, they will clearly have the capability to build a weapon in a very short amount of time, and that increases the risk of military action. And if it goes to that, if Israel strikes Iran, if we strike Iran, that won't just be a neat little, you know, overnight strike or 2 or 3 days of strike. That will be weeks of bombardment that will kill thousands of Iranians. That will be the beginning of a major war with Iran. Former Marine General Anthony Zinni says, if you like the wars with Afghanistan and Iraq, you're going to love the war with Iran. And that's what we'd be looking at, a major new war in the Middle East. And that would be a disaster for the United States, for Israel, for the entire region.
And we are talking with Joe Cirincione for about the next 10 minutes or so, president of the Plowshares Fund. He's also a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board. And we are talking about negotiations in Vienna between the P5 plus one and Iran over Iran's nuclear program. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joe, let me read a piece that was in the Washington Post, actually was here in the Inquirer as well, by Charles Krauthammer. He really slammed this deal. But let me just quote one of the things that he says. He says, the strongest military and economic power on Earth, backed by five other major powers, armed with what had been a crushing sanctions regime, is about to sign the worst international agreement in U.S. diplomatic history. Obama will get his legacy. Kerry will get his Nobel. And Iran will get the bomb.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Charles Krauthammer is one of the most widely read columnists in the country, and he's absolutely wrong on this, just as he was wrong about his rosy predictions of what would happen when we invaded Iraq. He was a big cheerleader for going to war with Iraq, and he's been frustrated not by the disaster that war turned out to be, but the fact that we left. So you have to understand, this agreement really brings to the fore this clash of worldviews. What is the U.S. role in the world? How should we be conducting our foreign relations? should we be negotiating with countries like Iran? And Charles Krauthammer says absolutely not. His touchstone is still World War II. For him, every negotiation is Munich. Every compromise is appeasement. The only victory he wants is if Iran were to unconditionally surrender the way the Japanese did on the deck of the battleship Missouri. So he doesn't want us to leave Iraq or Afghanistan, and he wants us to go to war with Iran. He's argued for this, that there's a military solution here, and he's joined by such leading neoconservative figures such as Bill Kristol at the Weekly Standard, and that's why he denounces this. And then they make the charge that somehow this will pave the way for Iran to get a nuclear weapon. It couldn't be farther from the truth. This agreement will block every path Iran has to possibly build a nuclear weapon. If they cheat, we'll know it, we'll catch them, and we'll punish them.
How much, though, do you think that Middle East politics, including the U.S.-led war in Iraq, are affecting negotiations? We see Iran's growing influence in Iraq, for instance. We see the rise of ISIS, the civil war in Syria. Does that in any way influence what happens at the table?
Well, there are many people like me who do look at this bigger picture and argue that U.S. national security would be served if we had more options in the region, so that we want to have relations with Iran. We want to have a working relationship that would help us in the battle against our common enemies like ISIS. ISIS is a sworn enemy of Iran's. Iranian forces are in Iraq right now on the ground battling ISIS in some of the same battles where we're doing airstrikes. So there's an overlap of strategic objectives that we have in the region, Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. But that is not what is guiding the U.S. negotiations. Every indication I have is those things are completely walled off from these negotiations. The administration isn't counting on this deal benefiting smoother relations with Iran. If it does, that's a plus, as long as it's on our terms. But that's not the reason we're doing this. We're doing this because it will stop the number one proliferation threat in the world, and that is the possibility of Iran getting a nuclear weapon and what that would mean for our ally Israel and for the region.
Let me get Bruce from Perkasie to join us on Radio Times. Bruce, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for this important issue, Marty.
You're welcome.
I'd be grateful if Mr. Cerenciani could comment on some great concerns I have. I'm glad we're higher because these negotiations, by their very nature, have us in the weeds and definitions and so forth. And if I understand it correctly, the concept is that after 10 years of commercial world involvement, Iran will awaken to the benefits of being friends and playing nicely in the playground. And my concern is that that's a fairyland, that this is a Iran is a religious theocracy governed by the country's clergy, and that when they say they have such existential opposition to our and Israel's concepts of a way of life, that we should take them seriously. Do you see my point?
I'm worried that there is
no end of this that works.
Well, let me see what Joe Cerenzioni has to say. Bruce, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We are dealing in many ways with a religious theocracy. Is that a problem, Joe?
Yes, it's a problem. I mean, America has deep, and not this isn't a liberal or conservative divide. All Americans have deep differences with the Iranian government, not the Iranian people, who, by the way, love us. I've been to Iran. Once they find out you're an American, they can't get enough of you.
Really? What do they want to know about you or us? What do they want to know?
They want what we have. They have the internet. They have satellite TV. They see us. You see kids in Levi's riding Vespas listening to American rock and roll. They want what we have. They don't like their government either. Americans are hugely popular in Iran, much more popular than we are, for example, in Pakistan or in Saudi Arabia, our allies. But the government remains a problem. So the question is, well, do you then what? Overthrow them? Do you go to war with them? Do you ignore them? That is not the way we've done business in the world. Even during the harshest days of the Cold War, we negotiated with the Soviet Union, a far bigger threat, with an ideology and a worldwide revolutionary network that was arming groups that were killing American soldiers. Even while that was happening, we negotiated with the Soviet Union. When Mao and Nixon met in 1972, the Chinese Communist Party was aiding the North Vietnamese, who that year had killed 2,000 Americans in Vietnam. Nixon still went. Why? Because what you want to do is reduce the threats that face you. And if you can find a negotiated agreement that can seal this nuclear program off, that can dismantle it, that can reduce it to a fraction of what it is, put it in an iron box and stick a camera on it, that's what you want to do. And if the price of that is to lift some of the sanctions that we put in place for this very purpose, the sanctions were to punish the regime. It was to get Iran to give on its nuclear program. If they give, you reduce the sanctions. Does that change the government? No, but it eliminates this threat.
Interesting Facebook comment from Jane. She says, well, if Iran wants nuclear for peaceful purposes, i.e. energy, why don't they focus on solar and wind power, something they have a lot of, and just skip the nuclear? Joe?
Well, this is one of the most oil-rich countries in the world, one-fifth of the world's oil reserves under its soil, one-quarter of the natural gas reserves. So when they start this ambitious nuclear program, you are suspicious. This is one of this part of the circumstantial evidence I talked about that makes you doubt the real purpose of this program. It doesn't help, frankly, that our allies in the region, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, have started their own ambitious nuclear program. Saudi Arabia wants to build 20 reactors now. We have suspicions that their purposes are not entirely peaceful either. So you want to nip this thing in the bud. You want to reduce as much as possible the non-peaceful imperatives that might lead to the nuclear programs and see if by doing that you can maybe convince them that there are cheaper, better, more sustainable ways to do. Iran is actually perfectly situated for wind power and for solar power. We'll see how that develops in the decades ahead. And this deal will close down their nuclear program for decades, for an entire generation. A lot of change can happen in a generation.
Well, on that note, Joe Cirincione, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times and getting us up to speed on these very important negotiations.
Thank you very much for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. President of the Plowshares Fund, that's a global security foundation, wrote a book called Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late. He's also a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board. Waiting in the wings, we have Mary Claire Dale, who's a reporter for the Associated Press, and Gail Sproul. She's a local attorney here in Philadelphia, and we'll be talking about a deposition that was opened earlier this week involving comedian Bill Cosby. That's coming up next here on Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The Associated Press went to court to get the release of a 2005 deposition in the sexual abuse case involving a former Temple University employee and comedian Bill Cosby. A Philadelphia federal judge unsealed the deposition on Monday this week over the objections of Cosby's lawyers. It revealed that Cosby admitted getting quaaludes to give to young women whom he was pursuing for sex. More than two dozen women have accused Bill Cosby of sexual misconduct. We asked Mary Claire Dale, Associated Reporter, for to join us for Radio Times. And Mary Claire Dale has been covering this story. And thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Gail Sproul. She's a partner with the Philadelphia law firm of Levine, Sullivan, Koch, and Schultz. And Gail Sproul, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Gail, why did you want the court to unseal these documents? What was the argument you were making for the Associated Press?
Well, the Associated Press wanted the documents unsealed, and we wanted them unsealed because of the obvious public interest in the documents, the importance of the documents, and the fact that documents that have been filed in court should be unsealed, should be free to the public and available online and in the clerk's office, unless there are mitigating circumstances, unless the party trying to seal them can show good cause. So our argument was that Mr. Cosby could not show good cause for the continued sealing of those documents, and the judge agreed with us.
To you, Mary Claire, what was this case about? This is a civil suit that goes back to 2005, and it did involve a Temple University employee who used to work at Temple University. She's actually named here. I'm not sure I want to say her name on the air, but what was this case about?
Right. The woman who knew Cosby through his advocacy and his work at Temple, he was a big, you know, cheerleader for the school and for the basketball team specifically. So she had gone, she was friendly with him. She had gone to his home for dinner, I believe with others, stayed to talk to him for career advice, and says she was later drugged and molested. And about a year later, back in her hometown, she talked to her parents and ultimately went to police and sought prosecution for it. The Montgomery County District Attorney thought there wasn't enough evidence a year later to prosecute. So she, with her attorney, filed a civil sex assault case that Cosby was deposed for, had to give, you know, sworn testimony, possibly the only sworn testimony we know he's given, although he's made remarks in the public, you know, court of public opinion, if you will. But these were portions of his deposition testimony answering questions about whether he would have drugged and, you know, molested women.
And there was a settlement in this case, and I guess both sides agreeing, Mary Claire, to a confidentiality agreement?
Right. Even the judge this week said he does not even know the terms of the settlement, so we don't know, you know, whether money, how much money, if any, changed hands. But there is an ironclad confidentiality agreement. But the records that were unsealed this week were the woman, the attorney for the woman, her lawyer had to go to court to get Cosby and his legal team to cooperate in the deposition. So these were the motions to compel and in that and a sanctions motion. And in that, we get excerpts of the deposition, but not yet his full deposition.
And I do want to read a couple of quotes. I'm back to you, Gail. Mm-hmm. Cosby's lawyers, their argument to keeping this deposition sealed was that he was not a public person. The judge did not agree. And what was the judge's argument?
Now, the judge said that actually his words are that Cosby is and was a quote-unquote public moralist. And he took particular note of the fact that Mr. Cosby had, for many, many years, gone around the country preaching certain types of behavior. And his conclusion, the judge's conclusion, was that by doing this, Mr. Cosby basically shrunk the zone of his privacy, so that when he was considering the privacy interests at issue here, what he concluded was that Mr. Cosby had very little privacy when it came to a case such as this, where morals were directly at issue.
Yeah, did you want to add something else?
Mm-hmm. No.
Okay, fair. Let me go to this transcript here, and I'll get a response from you, Mary Claire. This is someone, the lawyer, asking Bill Cosby a couple of questions, and the lawyer says, when you got the Quaaludes, was it in your mind that you were going to give these Quaaludes for young women that you wanted to have sex with? Bill Cosby says, yes. Then she asks, did you ever give any of these women the Quaaludes without their knowledge? And then his, I guess it looks like his lawyer interrupts and doesn't want him to answer that particular question. Is that a kind of a smoking gun under these circumstances?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if it's a smoking gun that shows criminality, at least, again, from the brief excerpts that we see. Later in the documents, there's a paraphrase, more or less, of that in which it says that Cosby, in his deposition testimony, says that he gave Quaaludes to two women knowingly. One of them was 19 at the time of their sexual encounter. So, you know, again, we can't say that these documents show proof of criminality, but we can show, I think, say that Cosby admits in his sworn testimony that he was using drugs to have sex with women as young as 19.
And these other women who have alleged sexual misconduct or even sexual abuse, Mary Claire, they have alleged or claimed very similar circumstances.
Right. Definitely the women in their arguments say that there's a pattern of behavior. You know, Cosby, of course, has accused some of them of being gold diggers or extortionists. But what's interesting is certainly in the case of the Temple University woman, when she first went to police, first contacted Cosby, I think her family first called Cosby, and all they wanted at the time was an apology and to know what was in the pills she took. He then offered her money for an educational trust fund, from what we know. And then, you know, the family decided to go to authorities.
Well, and part of this, I guess, deal with this trust fund, and I thought this was just so strange, Mary Claire, is that he said in order to get the money, she had to have a 3.0 average in order to get money for this trust fund.
I do remember reading some reference to that. I just didn't even know what to make of that.
Do you know what to make of that, Gail?
No. I think that this is what the judge picked upon. I mean, what he was saying is that Mr. Cosby was someone who advocated, you know, high-level moral behavior, and obviously good performance in school would qualify as one of those. But at the same time, the allegations, which are now reported to be made by more than 30 women, show a totally different type of person.
And he actually and his wife have established trust funds to help a number of people, young people looking for an education, Mary Claire.
They have, and I think some of the schools, you know, with which they've done that have now tried to distance themselves from Cosby. And I guess I read today that Walt Disney is taking down some sort of statue that was there of Cosby. So I think the court of public opinion is changing on this one, even, you know, with the limited information that we have.
Well, and there was this issue about Bill Cosby's privacy rights. But what about the person, Gail, who's the former Temple University employee? Have her privacy rights been invaded by this unsealing of the deposition?
She did not object. We didn't hear anything from the plaintiff's counsel when the AP went to court for the unsealing. Only the defendant objected, Cosby. And so, you know, we believe she doesn't feel that way. And in fact, 10 years ago when the case was active, she, at the very beginning, attempted to shield the identities of the other women who were expected to testify, who were referred to as the Jane Does. She later dropped that position. And so it's our understanding that she would not object to this, but she has not put that on the record.
Could this deposition, and this is, you know, sworn testimony, but do you think, Gail, this deposition could open the door to lawsuits, or is it the statute of limitations that would prevent that?
Well, I think there is a, you know, statute of limitations issue with respect to many of these allegations. It would depend on the particular circumstances of every incident or alleged incident. And the same is true for criminal charges. But what happened last year is that three of Mr. Cosby's accusers are now suing him for defamation because the statute of limitations has run on their assault claims. But one of his agents has said that these women essentially were making up their allegations. So they sued him for defamation because, in effect, he's saying that they lied. And so that's another way of pressing the charges, I guess you could say.
And we should say that Bill Cosby has never been charged with a crime in this case, correct?
Correct.
And I guess it's really more the court of public opinion, Mary Claire, there where this is really playing out.
In to some degree, there are renewed efforts, as Gail said, through the defamation suit, and Gloria Allred has a client who's trying to pursue a civil sexual abuse suit in Los Angeles in the California courts. Cosby and his lawyers are trying to stop that suit from moving forward. In fact, I think he was supposed to be deposed in that case last month, and their appeals to try to dismiss the case have, you know, delayed his deposition. It's a, you know, somewhat parallel legal case as I think the one that the Temple University woman pursued. So there are still some legal things going on. But again, you know, I guess he is perhaps equally importantly is that, you know, people that have been supporting him, even some celebrities and such, are now starting to question their positions on that.
And that's Mary Claire Dale. She's a reporter for the Associated Press. Also with us is Gail Sproul. She's a partner with the Philadelphia law firm of Levine, Sullivan, Koch, and Schultz. And we are talking about the fact that the Associated Press went to court to get the release of a 2005 deposition involving a sexual abuse case, a former Temple University employee charging comedian Bill Cosby. And if you want to join the conversation, any questions or comments, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mary Claire Dale, I noticed in the last, 12 or 24 hours, a number of the women who have alleged or accused Bill Cosby of sexual abuse do feel kind of vindicated or corroborated. And while they might not be able to go to court, it seems, at least the way they describe their reaction, they feel as if they've had some kind of justice.
They do, because for so long, again, you know, Cosby, through agents or through articles, interviews, really painted some of them, at least, out to be extortionists. In one case from these documents, we know he had a woman's story, her accusations that she was telling to a tabloid newspaper. He had that story killed in exchange for providing that tabloid with, you know, some sort of a feature on him. So these women over the years, it's been a long time. I mean, for many of them, 40 years. For somebody like the Temple woman, 10 years. And, you know, I think a lot of people felt like these were women coming out of the woodwork to try to get money from Cosby or something. And now, again, we still don't know the truth of each and every allegation. But this does at least lend some support to the fact that he, you know, says he obtained drugs and was pursuing young women while he was a married, you know, publicly moralizing man, a man who went out and, you know, moralized, you know, to the community about their behavior.
Let me get Gregory from Doylestown to join our conversation. Hi, Gregory. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, interesting thing about this is that Cosby's accuser, I don't believe she remained an employee at Temple University very long after this case broke. Cosby stayed off campus for about a year or so, but then he was brought back, and for nearly a decade afterwards, you know, he was, again, Temple's a face to the world. And it, I think this speaks to the fact that in a lot of these cases, you know, there's institutional collusion. We see, again, universities implicated in cases of date rape involving athletes. We see this happening in other institutions. And that's the thing, you know. It kind of permeates American culture. And so the more light that can be put on any of these cases, the better. And I think the broader questions need to be asked, too, so that institutions are reformed.
I appreciate the call, Greg, the call to Radio Times. We should say that Temple University has essentially disassociated itself with Bill Cosby, but that's a relatively recent development. Mary Clear, anything you want to add to that?
No, that's a really interesting point. Certainly the, you know, the woman, I think, was looking to make a career change, but I don't know if she left Temple, you know, very quickly after that. But I did see Cosby at Temple as recently as, about a year ago for a high profile public funeral. But I do appreciate the point the caller made.
Indeed. Gail, in terms of, I guess, the public's right to know, and in many ways that's what we're talking about, how far does that go? And it should be said that Cosby's lawyers were worried about details about his private life, about his marriage, about whatever drug use he might be having or doing, or even his sex life, that could embarrass him. I mean, how much should we know about this? Are we entitled to know about this?
Well, I think the judge's approach was the appropriate way to look at this, because what he did was essentially say there is a case that came from our Third Circuit, the federal court that is in charge of Philadelphia, that asked the court to look at a number of factors. But basically what it's doing is weighing the public interest against the private interests of the person. And what the judge is saying here is that by going out, not just by being a comedian or an entertainer, which is the way he portrayed himself in the case, but by being someone who actually preaches to the public about how they should act, and act in areas of fatherhood and marriage and love and, you know, community, that he basically shrunk his privacy interests. Mm. He's not like the average person, like, you know, you or me, who really nobody is interested in, because we haven't gone out to try to tell people what to do. And then if you put into the context of this case where his morals are directly challenged, the judge concluded, you know, outright. He said that the AP, and by extension the public, has a significant interest, mm-hmm. that's a quote from him, in this case, and that therefore Cosby, and the burden is on Cosby, not us, and that's significant, because what the judge is doing is saying the public interest should trump. And he said in this case that it did.
Well, to be continued. Gail Sproul, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Partner with the Philadelphia law firm Levine, Sullivan, Koch & Schultz. Mary Claire Dale, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And she's a reporter for the Associated Press. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including what you think about the conversation we just had. I'm Marty Moscowane. Do stay with us for Hour 2. We'll be right back.